for this June 14th, Flag Day. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us, and here are some of your Monday headlines. NATO leaders taking a hard line on China at the first summit attended by President Biden. In their communique, the leader saying China's, quote, assertive behavior presents systemic challenges to the international order and to areas relevant to alliance security. We'll have more with the president in Brussels just ahead. Tomorrow, the president meeting with EU leaders, and then on Wednesday, he sits down with Russian President Vladimir Putin, a one-on-one session in Geneva, Switzerland. In an NBC News interview, Putin denying ordering the assassination attempt of his critic, Alexei Navalny, and disavowing any knowledge of cyber attacks aimed at U.S. businesses. Meanwhile, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson postponing the lifting of all remaining COVID restrictions. It comes amid a rising number of cases as a result of that new Delta variant across the U.K., Prime Minister announcing that he is delaying what the Brits have called Freedom Day, originally set for June 21st. It's been delayed by 4 weeks to July 19th. Here in the U.S., governors are beginning to reopen. In California, for example, starting tomorrow, you will no longer be required to social distance and businesses open to full capacity. The House and Senate both back in session this week. Infrastructure once again leading the conversation on Capitol Hill. Just some of the stories shaping Washington Today. It's all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin, though, in Brussels, where President Biden used his first NATO summit since taking office to join other members of the military alliance in calling for a response to China's growing power and for the ongoing challenges from Russia. It followed a series of lengthy meetings that went well into the evening European time. The president then spoke to reporters at a closing news conference.
I had the honor of leading off the discussion today among the 30 nations. And I pointed out that we're facing a once-in-a-century global health crisis. At the same time, the democratic values that undergird our alliance are under increasing pressure, both internally and externally. Russia and China are both seeking to drive a wedge in our transatlantic solidarity. We're seeing an increase in malicious cyber activity. But our alliance is a strong foundation on which we can, our collective security and our shared prosperity can continue to be built. And I made a point to make clear that the U.S. commitment to Article 5, the NATO Treaty, is rock solid and unshakable. It's a sacred commitment. NATO stands together. That's how we've met every other threat in the past. It's our greatest strength as we meet our challenges of the future, and there are many. And everyone in that room today understood the shared appreciation, quite frankly, that America is back. We talked about Russia's aggressive acts that pose a threat to NATO and our collective security. That's why I met with the Bucharest Nine, the Eastern Flank allies, in advance of this summit. And today I also met with the leaders of the three Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. I shared with our allies that I'll convey to President Putin that I'm not looking for conflict with Russia, but that we will respond if Russia continues its harmful activities. And we will not fail to defend the transatlantic alliance or stand up for democratic values. As allies, we also affirmed our continued support for the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine.
The president at the NATO meeting in Brussels. He'll continue his conversations tomorrow with European leaders. But as you heard just a moment ago, all eyes on Wednesday's one-on-one session with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Geneva, Switzerland. Now, the president said he spoke about Russia's actions on cybersecurity with NATO leaders, posing a real threat to the West. And the president at today's news conference was asked about that story and also the recent poisoning of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. The question from CBS News White House correspondent Nancy Cordes.
Thank you, Mr. President. I also have two questions about Vladimir Putin. The first is, have any of the world leaders you've met with this week expressed concern that by meeting with President Putin this early in your presidency, that it'll look like you're rewarding him?
What's your second question?
The second question is what it will mean for the U.S.-Russia relationship if Alexei Navalny were to die or be killed in prison.
Every world leader here as a member of NATO that spoke today, and most of them mentioned it, thanked me for meeting with Putin now. Every single one that spoke. And I think there were probably about 10 or 12 that spoke to it, saying they were happy that I did that, that I was going to do that. And they thought it was thoroughly appropriate that I do. And I had discussions with them about, in the open, about what they thought was important from their perspective and what they thought was not important. And so the interesting thing is, I know, and I'm not being critical of the press, I really mean this, give my word, but generically you all thought it was Biden meeting him too soon. I haven't found a world leader who doesn't think it's not soon, it's just soon enough. Everyone that I've spoken to, privately and publicly, it doesn't mean there aren't some out there, but it's not likely that a head of state is going to stand up in front of 29 other heads of state and say, boy, I'm glad you're doing this, in effect. So there is a consensus. And they thanked me for being willing to talk with them about the meeting and what I was what I intended to do. So I haven't found any reluctance. There may be someone, but not in open today or in the meetings I privately had as well. And Navalny's death would be another indication that Russia has little or no intention of abiding by basic fundamental human rights. It would be a tragedy. It would do nothing but hurt his relationships with the rest of the world, in my view, and with me.
That with the president earlier today. By the way, we have posted the entire news conference. It's on our homepage at cspan.org. Meanwhile, Russian President Putin denying ordering the assassination attempt of his Kremlin critic, Alexei Navalny. The president just talking about that a moment ago. And Putin again claiming he has no knowledge about cyber attacks aimed at the U.S. and American businesses. Part of a lengthy NBC News interview, his response through a translator.
The Russian court has just outlawed organizations connected to Mr. Navalny. Literally every non-systematic opposition figure is facing criminal charges. Mr. President, it's as if dissent is simply not tolerated in Russia anymore.
Well, you are presenting it as dissent and intolerance towards dissent in Russia. We view it completely differently.
Will you commit that you will personally ensure that Alexei Navalny will leave prison alive?
I proceed from the premise that the person that you have mentioned, the same kind of measures will apply, not in any way worse than to anybody else who happens to be in prison.
His name is Alexei Navalny. People will note that you were prepared to say that he would leave prison alive.
That with Keir Simmons of NBC News. And by the way, this marking the first time the Russian leader Vladimir Putin has been interviewed by an American news organization in 3 years. It's been posted on the NBC News website. Meanwhile, the president, as we indicated earlier in Brussels, for a meeting with NATO alliance leaders and Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, who talked about the 30-country alliance established, of course, in the wake of World War II as a way to counter the geopolitical ambitions of the Soviet Union, calling today's meeting a pivotal moment in its 72-year history. The head of NATO is also asked about his relationship with President Biden.
Thank you. Michael Birnbaum from The Washington Post. Thanks very much for this. Can I just ask, can you compare your experience at this summit with the U.S. delegation to your experience at summits with President Trump? And was President Biden able to tell you anything that convinced you that Trump or another Trump-like figure won't be back in the White House in a few years and swing the United States back to a more confrontational approach to NATO? Thank you.
It is different. Then I think that the important thing for me now is to convey a very clear message that was also conveyed in the meeting today, that all allies welcome the strong commitment from President Biden to NATO and the bond between Europe and North America in NATO. And that in return, all the other allies, Canada and Europe, expressed the same strong commitment that we have to stand together in NATO in a more competitive world. That's the important thing. I welcome that. That was the message from President Biden when I met him in the White House a week ago, and that's the message from President Biden and his administration today in the summit. Then I would like to add the following, and that is that I think what we learned over the previous 4 years was the importance of strong multilateral institutions in uncertain times. Because NATO as an alliance, as an institution, goes beyond individual political leaders. We can weather political winds and different storms. So if anything, it just proves the importance of building a strong NATO. There will be different political leaders elected in many allied countries in the years to follow. But I'm confident that as long as we realize that it is in our security interest to stand together, national security interest to stand together, we will maintain NATO as the bedrock for our security. Also welcome the fact that we have very strong bipartisan support in the United States for NATO. But if you look at the recent opinion polls published from different sources over the last weeks, it confirms a very strong support for NATO in general, both in North America and in Europe. So I cannot tell you who will be the next political leaders in 30 NATO allied countries, but I can tell you that what we have seen is the strength of strong institutions like NATO, which can deal with also different political leaders that have different opinions about many issues, as we have seen over many years in NATO.
That from Jens Stoltenberg. He is the NATO Secretary General following a one-day meeting in Brussels with President Biden. Here in this country, Attorney General Merrick Garland announcing today that the Justice Department would revamp its policies for collecting records from lawmakers. This following revelations that under the Trump administration, the department did obtain records from two Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee. The Attorney General's statement reads in part, quote, "As I stated during my confirmation hearing, political or other improper considerations must play no role in any investigative or prosecutorial decisions. These principles that have long been held sacrosanct by DOJ career workforce will be guarded on my watch. Any failure to live up to them will be met with strict accountability." Now, the statement comes as the Justice Department is under increasing pressure for its handling of leak investigations initiated under the Trump administration that sought the records of, among others, the House Intelligence Committee Chair Adam Schiff, Democrat of California, and Eric Swalwell, another Democratic member of Congress from California, as well as journalists from at least three media outlets and even the former White House counsel, Don McGahn. Now, late this afternoon, the Attorney General did meet with media executives from CNN, The Washington Post, and The New York Times to further discuss those phone records obtained by the Justice Department. And this issue came up today in an event sponsored by The Washington Post with the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Virginia Senator Mark Warner, Post columnist Karen Tumulty conducting the interview.
What I think we're seeing is that it was worse than all of us even imagined. We knew that, unfortunately, the Department of Justice had become, in a sense, a personal arm of the Donald Trump protection racket. Bill Barr was more interested in being Donald Trump's personal enforcer than the nation's top law enforcement official. And these stories sound Nixonian, but they're actually worse than Nixonian. So I do hope Merrick Garland, whether it's through an IG or other process, gets to the bottom of this, makes clear that a Biden Justice Department would not be going after journalists, not be going after political opponents. I hope this is a dark chapter that we can close. And I do hope, as others have called, that those who are responsible be held accountable.
But won't an IG investigation take a long time? I mean, is that aggressive enough as a step here? Or are there other things that you would like to see Merrick Garland and the Justice Department doing? I mean, we have news just this morning that John Demers, who heads the National Security Division of the Justice Department is stepping down. Do we need to see more action out of them?
Well, Karen, I think an IG properly empowered can act quickly. Matter of fact, in many ways, being having the operations of an inspector general's office is the appropriate place. We also need to see, I think the IG will be more familiar with traditional leak investigations. If there is a faster, more efficient process, I'm open to that. I'm not sure that a separate congressional review would actually speed that process up. I think the most important thing is that we find those who were accountable, hear why they took what appears to be, at least on the surface, outrageous actions. If there was any kind of appropriate argument, we ought to hear that. Again, the comparisons to the Nixonian Justice Department, it's actually makes Nixon look better than what Trump was doing.
That from Senator Mark Warner. He is the chair of the Senate Intel Committee. The full interview is available at WashingtonPost.com. We also covered it for the C-SPAN networks. You can check it out on our website at cspan.org. Meanwhile, the Senate Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, saying he is willing to step into Senate Republican primaries next year to prevent a candidate they view as unelectable in November of 2022. Now, his comments came in an interview this morning with conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt. And when asked if the Senate GOP Leadership Fund would be willing to intervene in 2022 Republican primaries, Senator McConnell's response was, quote, if necessary. That was just one of a number of headlines to come out of that conversation. He was also asked about where things stand for a possible bipartisan deal on infrastructure.
Most Americans, and certainly Kentucky's senior senator, are familiar with pre-race odds at the Kentucky Derby. This year they were from 9-2 up to 49-1. Where would you put the odds in that context for the $974 billion hard infrastructure proposal from the Gang of Ten?
Well, you know, maybe 50-50. Both sides would like to get an infrastructure bill. Here are the red lines on our side. We're not going to reopen the 2017 tax bill. It was the major factor in bringing us the best economy in 50 years as of February 2020 before the pandemic hit. And we want it to be paid for. And the gas tax produces a certain amount of money every year. That's declined some because of fuel efficiency and electric cars. To the extent that we want to go above that, it needs to be credibly paid for. And our suggestion is, it just flooded the country with an enormous amount of money. States and localities are literally awash in extra money. A lot of that is still in the pipeline. Why don't we repurpose that, earmark it for infrastructure, which most localities would prefer to spend it on anyway, and that would be a good way to get a pretty robust infrastructure bill on a bipartisan basis without raising taxes.
But any tax raise means red line means no 60 votes.
Well, they're going to try. Yeah. I mean, if they want it to be bipartisan, it'll have to be done with 60 votes. And, you know, every single Republican voted for the 2017 tax bill. We think it clearly produced the best economy in 50 years. We don't want to break what isn't, it doesn't need fixing. And so raising the taxes, revisiting the 30-year comprehensive tax bill, is not a good way to go forward.
Senator McConnell made his comments on the Hugh Hewitt program earlier today, and joining us on the phone is Mike DeBonis, congressional reporter for The Washington Post. With regard to infrastructure, which really seems to be the story of the summer, where are we? Where do things stand?
Well, thanks for having me, Steve. The action right now on infrastructure is with a group of 10 senators, 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, who say they have a bipartisan structure, framework, whatever you want to call it, to spend $1 trillion over the next 8 years on so-called hard infrastructure, roads, bridges, pipelines, broadband. And, you know, right now this is, you know, kind of the focus of attention, if for no other reason than, you know, you need the Democrats involved in this to support anything, whether or not you have Republicans on board and they want to give this a shot. And so they're going through the process right now. The White House is evaluating this proposal. And, you know, I think this is seen pretty widely as a make or break week for these talks, although we've said that in previous weeks and the talks have kept on going. So we're just going to be watching very closely how the White House reacts to what this group has put together. And we're also watching how, you know, rank and file Democrats react to what this group of moderate Democrats, moderate Republicans is proposing, and whether it goes far enough as far as they want to go in terms of, building infrastructure and doing a lot of other things that they feel that they can do with a completely partisan bill using the reconciliation process. So that's all coming to a head this week, and we're keeping an eye on it.
Is the White House and the president in particular facing the most pressure? Because clearly, working across the aisle, bipartisanship was one of the campaign promises by the president. If not this issue, then what?
Right, exactly. And, you know, that's been sort of a sentiment that's, you know, hung around Washington for a long time, which is, you know, if you can't do something like infrastructure on a bipartisan basis, what can you do? Well, the truth is that there's a lot of partisanship that's sort of embedded in infrastructure, you know, none more so than on the question of, you know, federal spending and taxation. And, you know, there are just very serious philosophical conflicts between the parties on how much the federal government needs to spend and how it needs to raise revenue. And, you know, Republicans have been very clear from the beginning. They don't want to see any rollback of the 2017 Republican tax cut. That means that, you know, a lot of things are off the table: corporate tax hike, personal income tax hike, any number of other things. And basically what they're looking at are, you know, are around the edges. You know, there's things like a potential tax on electric vehicles. There's reusing money that was passed earlier this year as part of the President Biden's rescue plan. There was briefly talk of raising the gas tax, or at least indexing it to inflation, but that seems to be sort of falling off the radar. And so there's just, while building roads and bridges and all that other good stuff is certainly something you know people want to do across party lines, the nuts and bolts of how to do it is extremely partisan, extremely ideological.
We're talking with Mike DeBonis of The Washington Post. The interview with Hugh Hewitt getting some news today, including this question on a hypothetical: what happens in 2024 with the Supreme Court? Let's listen.
If you regain the majority in 2022 for the Republicans, and there's a very good chance of that happening, I'll come back to the individual races in a second, would the rule that you applied in 2016 to the Scalia vacancy apply in 2024 to any vacancy that occurred then?
Well, I think in the middle of a presidential election, if you have a Senate of the opposite party of the president, you have to go back to the 1880s to find the last time a vacancy was filled. So I think it's highly unlikely. In fact, no, I don't think either party, if it were different from the president, would confirm a Supreme Court nominee in the middle of an election. That what was different in 2020 was we were of the same party as the
president,
and that's why we went ahead with it.
Mike DeBonis, as you hear that exchange with Hugh Hewitt, what stands out? Any news from that?
Well, you know, Senator McConnell, you know, led the blockade of Merrick Garland in 2016 after the death of Antonin Scalia. So, you know, there was no doubt that he's willing to play the hardest of hardballs when it comes to the issue of judicial nominations. It's literally the issue he cares the most about. He sees it as truly his legacy as the Republican Senate leader. And while he didn't give a definitive question about the 2024 question, I mean, I think there's very few people who observe the Senate, who work in the Senate, who know Mitch McConnell, who think that if he were the majority leader, he would do everything he could to make sure that a Republican, not a Democrat, filled that seat. So in that sense, it's not surprising. But, you know, he's not been asked in that way before. And kudos to Hugh Hewitt for getting him on the record. And I think that it demonstrates that, you know, even with the stamp that he has already left on the federal judiciary, he believes his work is not done. And we'll see how much longer Mitch McConnell will be in a position to act on that agenda.
The House and Senate both in session this week and the next couple of weeks before the July 4th break. What else are you looking at?
Well, the Senate's going to be doing nominations this week. Nothing too surprising. Tonight, on Monday evening, they're expected to confirm the First Circuit judge nominee of President Biden's Ketanji Brown Jackson to the D.C. Circuit, replacing Merrick Garland, who became Attorney General. Some executive branch appointments later this week. In the House, something interesting, the House is going to vote this week on undoing the authorization for use of military force that was passed by Congress in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. This is something that's been actually been a priority for certain members of both parties who believe that Congress needs to take a much more active role in authorizing the use of military force against terrorist forces in the Middle East. And, you know, this particular resolution has been used quite broadly to authorize a whole host of military actions. And there's a lot of people in Congress who would like to take a different approach. The House is going to vote for this. It's expected to pass, but I'm not aware of any plans right now of moving it forward in the Senate. Notably, however, the Biden administration did put out a statement Monday saying that they support revisiting the 2001 AOMF, and we'll see where it goes from here.
The House is live on C-SPAN, the Senate live on C-SPAN 2, and the reporting of Mike DeBonis in the newspaper and WashingtonPost.com. Thank you for being with us.
Anytime, Steve. Thanks.
And welcome back. This is Washington Today for Monday, June 14th. Here are some of your COVID-19 headlines. Axios.com reporting that the CEOs of 178 healthcare companies in the U.S. collectively made $3.2 billion during the coronavirus pandemic. That, by the way, is 31% more than 2019. The highest priced CEO is the head of Masimo, which is a medical device company, earning $210 million last year. And in New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio announcing that New York will host a ticker tape parade. It will take place on July 7th to honor those healthcare workers, first responders, and essential workers. It will be the city's first official parade since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. The Maryland-based biotech company Novavax reporting today that its experimental COVID-19 vaccine is safe and 100% effective against moderate to severe disease. The results are from the company's phase 3 clinical trials conducted in the U.S. and in Mexico, meaning we could soon have a fourth vaccine available for the market. The company's CEO, Stanley Erck, was asked about these developments in an interview earlier today on CNBC.
Tell us about what the results showed and also about the tolerability profile. Some are saying this might be an easier vaccine to take than some of the others that are available.
Yeah, thanks, Megan. It's always good to talk with you. So, yeah, it's a big day today. We've unblinded our biggest trial yet, which is 30,000 enrollees. And as you say, we've got 90% efficacy overall. But there's some interesting tidbits in there. One is we all worry about variants across the world. And in this particular trial, there are a lot of variants. We had 82% of our 82% of our disease was caused by variants. We had 93% efficacy against that, which is great. And you also worry about the most severe and moderate. So we categorize our disease as mild, moderate, severe. We had zero moderate, severe. So we had 100% protection there. And so that's just tremendous data. We couldn't have asked for better. We also had a safety profile, and this is consistent throughout our UK phase 3 trial in South Africa. We have a very benign safety profile, and so that's going to be important, as you say.
Stanley Urk is the company's CEO. His interview on CNBC earlier today. Now, because of the current surplus of vaccines here in our country, it is unlikely that Novavax's shots will be used as the first line of defense in the U.S. The company is saying that it would be used in the coming months or even the years ahead, especially, as you heard just a moment ago, with new concerns over variants, in particular those from India. However, other parts of the world do remain vulnerable. At this G7 summit over the weekend in England, President Biden joining other European leaders, pledging to donate up to 1 billion vaccine doses to those countries in need of them. Now, as states begin to reopen, California announcing today it will begin giving away travel packages for vacation destinations. Yet another incentive to get more people vaccinated against COVID-19. It's in partnership with Visit California. Governor Gavin Newsom saying that this latest incentive is part of the Vax for the Win program that also includes cash prizes for Californians who get inoculated with one of the coronavirus vaccines. All of this coming as the state begins to reopen officially tomorrow with a warning from the governor. His remarks in San Francisco earlier today.
This is not spiking the football tomorrow. It's not mission accomplished tomorrow. This virus is not going away tomorrow. This pandemic's not behind us tomorrow. We're very mindful that already in 2021, globally, more people have lost their lives to COVID than the entire year, 2020. We're very mindful, as was noted just a moment ago, of all the variants, not least of which our own West Coast variants, of which there are two, and the majority of variants we're seeing now across the country, particularly the B117, the UK variant. UK variant in the state of California is not yet a majority of those that we are sequencing. The West Coast continues to be, but again, we're mindful of that, mindful of the W mutation coming out of India, mindful of the summer months, mindful of those states that do not have vaccination rates nearly as high as our state. Mindful that we are one large state. There are places like Lassen County that have, last I looked, about 26% of their population in that county vaccinated. You're over 80% here in San Francisco, 88%+ in Marin, 83%+ in San Diego. So that differentiation regionally, globally, variants, that's why we want to continue the incentives. That's why we are announcing the incentive draw on July 1st here for these vacations. We said that those $50 cards would continue as supplies last, 2 million cards in total. We are pleased that Taco Bell, Chipotle have also done incentives starting tomorrow. Those very addictive Dorito tacos, for example, you can get one free if you're vaccinated starting tomorrow. Maybe that's the incentive you need. Others like the Warriors and the Clippers are doing discounts at the Chase Center starting tomorrow through the 25th. You get 20% off of all Warriors merchandise. So we're aligning with the CDC. We have some workplace issues as it relates to self-attestation we have to work through. People. We hope we'll be honest about that, and we are consistent with the CDC as it relates to a process where people we recommend, consistent with the CDC, if you haven't been vaccinated and you're in public or you're in a large indoor setting, we encourage mask wearing, and that's the CDC framework, but again, it's on the basis of trust, and that's the system that is in place nationally. It's a system being placed in the state of California.
That from Governor Gavin Newsom as the state reopens with a cautionary note on COVID-19. Vermont has also lifted all remaining COVID restrictions after reaching the milestone of 80% of eligible residents receiving at least one vaccine dose. Vice President Kamala Harris today kicking off a nationwide vaccination tour. She did so in Greenville, South Carolina. And in Massachusetts, the mass coronavirus vaccination site at Gillette Stadium is now shutting down after administering more than 600,000 doses. Meanwhile, in Great Britain, plans to lift all COVID-19 restrictions on June 21st. Those plans have been scuttled. The reason, as we've been hearing during the course of this program, the Delta variant of the virus. Despite UK's successful vaccine rollout, which has given two doses to more than half of the adult population, this new strain, which was first identified in India, means that the Freedom Day, which is what British citizens were calling it, has been pushed into July. More from the Prime Minister.
Vaccination greatly reduces transmission, and two doses provide a very high degree of protection against serious illness and death. But there are still millions of younger adults who have not been vaccinated, and sadly, a proportion of the elderly and vulnerable may still succumb even if they have had two jabs. And that's why we're so concerned by the Delta variant that is now spreading faster than the third wave that was predicted in the February roadmap. We're seeing cases growing by about 64% per week, and in the worst affected areas, it's doubling every week. And the average number of people being admitted to hospital in England has increased by 50% week on week and by 61% in the Northwest, which may be the shape of things to come, because we know the remorseless logic of exponential growth. And even if the link between infection and hospitalization has been weakened, it hasn't been severed. And even if the link between hospitalization and death has also been weakened, I'm afraid numbers in intensive care, in ICU, are also rising. And so we've obviously faced a very difficult choice. We can simply keep going with all of step four on June the 21st, even though there is a real possibility that the virus will outrun the vaccines and that thousands more deaths would ensue that could otherwise have been avoided. Or else, we can give the NHS a few more crucial weeks to get those remaining jabs into the arms of those who need them. And since today, I cannot say that we have met all our four tests for proceeding with step four on June the 21st. I think it is sensible to wait just a little longer.
And so with that, a four-week extension of any restrictions, that update earlier today from British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow losing 85 points, but the tech-heavy NASDAQ closing at a new high, gaining more than 100 points today, and the S&P was up 7. Meanwhile, inflation continues to worry investors. The head of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, believes cash is king, at least for the time being. The largest U.S. bank in terms of assets has been effectively stockpiling cash rather than using it to buy treasuries or other investments. The reason? Concerns over the possibility of higher inflation forcing the Federal Reserve to boost interest rates. In a conference call, he told investors the company has $500 billion in cash sitting on the sidelines just in case. And news from the Energy Department today announcing it will be pushing to cut the cost of low-carbon hydrogen by 80% by the year 2031. Abby Smith covers the energy beat for the Washington Examiner, and she told us this is one of the first priorities for the department and for the Biden administration.
So the Energy Department is focusing on decreasing the cost of zero-carbon hydrogen from roughly $5 per kilogram today to $1 per kilogram by the end of this decade, about 80% cost cut. So they're really looking to make hot, clean hydrogen a fuel that can be used in everything from heavy-duty trucks to shipping. It can store power. It can also be piped through pipelines and help heat homes. That's the vision. But right now, clean hydrogen is too expensive for companies to be using that widespread. So the Energy Department will be really marshaling its scientific resources, its research dollars to help find ways to decrease the cost to produce this clean hydrogen, either through renewable energy, nuclear power, or natural gas with carbon capture.
Are there examples of other countries that are doing this and doing it effectively?
Definitely. Right now, we're seeing Japan, the European Union are two that really come to mind as the countries and regions that are going all in on hydrogen. The European Union is setting a pretty aggressive goal to deploy 40 gigawatts of electrolyzers, which are essentially the machines that split water into hydrogen and oxygen atoms. They want to deploy 40 gigawatts of that by 2030 as part of their European Green Deal. Japan also has a comprehensive strategy on hydrogen, trying to deploy that in its own country as well. So the U.S. is a little bit behind the eight ball on this. We don't have a national strategy here. President Biden has talked a lot about hydrogen. So has Secretary Kerry, Climate Envoy Kerry. They really do support this technology, but right now we just don't have the same national strategy that other regions around the world do. So this is a first step to try to get us there, but we'll see what else President Biden and his team come up with.
Well, let me take that one step further. You do quote the Energy Secretary, Jennifer Granholm, who says that clean hydrogen is a game changer. But specifically, how do we get there? 80% is an ambitious goal.
it is an ambitious goal. And I think right now we don't have all the answers of how we get there. The Energy Department is putting forward funding opportunities. It's really leaning into innovation and its research arm to try to figure out ways to cut the cost of electrolyzers. Part of this comes from scaling up the technology. So folks in the industry tell me, you know, we really need the dollars to have demonstration projects to demonstrate this technology so we can scale it up. And with scale comes cost decline. But right now, we only have a couple demonstration projects here in the U.S., smaller scale. So they really want to scale up the projects to help bring down that cost. Some of it, though, still is, you know, a question mark of how the Energy Department, how the Biden administration can get to that cost decline.
Abby Smith, she is an energy and environment reporter. Her work available at WashingtonExaminer.com. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Also today in Israel, the new coalition government is in place. Incoming Foreign Minister Yair Lapid vowing to repair ties between Israel and the U.S. He spoke at a ceremony where he took over as the new foreign minister of that country, accusing now former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of abandoning the diplomatic corps and, in his words, leaving it in shambles.
There are a series of main arenas that were abandoned. Operations with the Democratic Party in the United States were shameful and dangerous, and I shouted about it more than once, but the outgoing administration made the bad choice to focus only on the Republicans and to abandon our bipartisan position. The Republicans are important for us, but not just them. We find ourselves, as you know perfectly well, with a Democratic White House, a Senate, a Democratic Senate, a Democratic House of Representatives, and these Democrats are angry, and we have to change how we work with them. Last night, I spoke to the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, and both of us believe that we can and must build relations with the administration based on mutual respect and a better dialogue, both with world Jewry and American Jewry. We need a change. The fact that we're supported by evangelical groups and other groups in the United States is important, and I'm happy for it, but the Jews of the world are more than allies, they are partners. World Jewry, from all stripes, Reform, conservative, Orthodox, our family, and family is always the most important tie, and we must cultivate it more than anything else. Also, with the current countries of the European Union, the situation isn't good enough. The relationship with some of the governments has been neglected. To shout that everyone is anti-Semitic is not a policy, and it's not an action plan, even if it feels right.
Foreign Minister Lapid of Israel, this new Israeli government is an alliance of right-wing, left-wing, centrist, and Islamist parties, all sworn into office yesterday, ending Benjamin Netanyahu's 12-year term in office. And for Netanyahu, this ends the longest leadership role in Israel's history. He's critical of this new coalition government. His response through a translator.
This fraudulent government will fall quickly, and I will tell you why. Three things unite it: hatred, exclusion, and domination. Those are the three things: the desire for domination, which knows no limits, which has swept away any principles and is crystal clear. A government with so many contradictions can never stay together. With such hatred, one can't keep a government over time.
That from the now former Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's available as a podcast. Be sure to listen and follow wherever you get your favorite podcast. For this Monday edition, happy Flag Day. I'm Steve Scully. Hope you enjoy the rest of your evening.